Thank you. Thank you. Well, oh, cheers. Do they let you bring drinks in? No? God, it can be thirsty work, you know, sitting watching someone else drink for about 3¾ hours. I expect some of you will smuggle them in the second half. People are usually quite creative about that. Handbags and under armpits of big coats and stuff like that. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be here. I came to this university for an interview once and didn't get in. So it's terrific to be back here. And I was just, there's a notice board backstage, and I was just looking at it before I came on. There was the local newspaper cutting about the new season here, and it said, highlights include Lou Reed, Pete McCarthy, and Noddy. So now, because people are always saying to me, what is it you do for a living? And I never know quite how to describe it. And now I can say, well, you know, I do the same sort of thing as Lou Reed and Noddy. And it'll make sense to people. Really, I think the first thing I should do this evening, really, is to apologise to people who've just started to realise they've come to see the wrong bloke tonight. This can happen. I was over in Ireland last year, and my publishers asked me, would I open the new bookstall at Cork Airport? And they said, oh, you know, you can just go in and do a little sign-in. And I thought, oh, God, I don't want to do that, because I don't mind doing things like tonight, where you come along and you do a show and then you sign books afterwards. But I've always dreaded being one of those lonely authors, you see, sitting in the corner of a bookshop, hoping that their friends or relatives will come in and ask them to sign something, you know. And they said, no, don't worry, it'll be fantastic, we'll make it a really sociable event. So I agreed to go to Cork Airport, and I got there, and this little bookstall, it's in Departure Side in Cork Airport. And so they put there's a little trestle table out with some warm white wine on, and there was a load of Ryanair passengers, because they always like a free drink, don't they? And there were some pilots and some customs people, and some of those alarmingly orange women who sell cosmetics at airports. We had a nice enough time, and then it came to time to be sort of packing up, you know, and there was one guy kind of lurking on the fringes of things and clearly wondering, you know, kept on picking up McCarthy's bar and thinking, oh, is it worth $6.99 and putting it back down and coming back over again. And I said, look, you know, we've been here long enough. So we started packing up, and this guy came running up. He said, oh, Mr. McCarthy, he said, before you go, he said, I'm going to get your book. He said, would you mind signing it for me? And I said, sure, you know, no problem. And he said, oh, would you sign it for Desi, please, Mr. McCarthy? I said, yeah, sure, signed it. And he said, tell me, Mr. McCarthy, he said, do you still see a lot of that Brian Keenan and Terry Waite? And I said, not as much as I used to, Desi, no. Enjoy the book, won't you? And anyway, a couple of months after that, I was on at this literature festival down at Dartington Hall in Devon. And when the programme arrived, I saw that I was on the same night as Brian Keenan. You know, and this is a guy I've always been in awe of, you know. I don't know if you read his book. He wrote a wonderful book about his time as a hostage, An Evil Cradling. It's incredible. And it makes you feel, I mean, it made me feel really humble, made me realise, you know, that I would never have the spirit to endure what he endured. So I was really looking forward, to seeing him perform and maybe getting a word with him afterwards. Anyway, when I got there, I discovered that our events overlapped, so I wasn't going to be able to see him. And then afterwards, there was no sign of him. So anyway, next morning, I went down to breakfast. And they have this separate breakfast room at this festival for authors, you know, so they don't have to mix with any scum or riffraff. So I sat there on my own at 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And in came Brian Keenan. And he went over and got some Weetabix from the buffet thing. And he came over and said, oh, can I join you? And join me at the table. I thought, blimey, it's Brian Keenan, you know. And anyway, he was very nice and sort of put me at my ease. And we chatted away and we had our breakfast. So at the end of the breakfast, I told him the story I just told you about being mistaken for John McCarthy in Cork Airport. And Brian Keenan told me that when they were first released from Lebanon, when their time as hostages ended, they came back, and Brian was living in this little house out on the west coast of Ireland near Westport in County Mayo, a little cottage looking out over the Atlantic. And he said he needed a lot of time on his own, you know, just to adjust to being free again. But he also had use of a flat back in Dublin, and he could go there at weekends if he wanted to, or, you know, whenever he wanted. So sometimes McCarthy would come over from England, and they would just spend a bit of time together. You know, they'd bonded so closely during their time in imprisonment together. And Brian told me that one weekend, John McCarthy came over and they'd arranged to meet in this little pub out in the Dublin Hills, about 10 miles from the airport, where they could just be inconspicuous, you know, and just spend some time together without anyone, you know, remarking on it or anything. So John McCarthy arrived at Dublin Airport off the plane from Heathrow or somewhere, and he gets into a taxi and says where he wants it to go. And they're driving off in the taxi from Dublin Airport. And the taxi driver looked in the mirror and said, don't I know you from somewhere? And John McCarthy said, well, yeah, maybe, I'm not sure. And he said, have you got a TV show or something? And John said, well, not really. All right, so they drive a bit further, and he's still looking at him in the mirror, and he says, I've seen you on TV, though, haven't I? And John said, well, yeah, you might have done once. You know, all right, you know. And so they go a bit further, and he says, I know you, he says. You're John McCarthy, the Beirut hostage, aren't you? And John said, yeah, I am, actually. Pause of another 20 or 30 seconds, and the driver said, wouldn't you be more comfortable in the boot? True story. So, now look, I really enjoy these evenings. Some authors don't like leaving the home or leaving the office. They don't like confronting the public, the readership. But I really enjoy it because, you know, writing books is it's a really solitary way of earning a living. You know, the reality of it is you spend all day, you know, every day in a room on your own. And also when I do the traveling on my own. So, I mean, I suppose it's a sad sort of thing to admit, but evenings like this more or less constitute my social life these days. You know, I can come along and, you know, I can sort of pretend I'm in the kitchen at a party or something, you know, a room full of close friends and acquaintances. But what I hadn't realised when I started doing evenings like this is that it would be a two-way process, that, you know, I come along here and tell my stories, but I also find that, you know, stories come back to me as well. And it started happening from very early on. And McCarthy's Bar was published in June of 2000. And quite soon after that, I started getting letters, more of the letters in a little while. But at events like this, when I was signing books afterwards, as I will be doing tonight, I find that people would come, and I don't know whether it's because they feel they know me from the books or something, but they start telling me all sorts of stuff about themselves, about their own families or their own journeys or, you know, Irish relatives or whatever it might happen to be. And one of the first times I recall it happening was, as I say, the book came out in June. I think it was in September. I was in Manchester at Waterstones Bookshop, and I did this little reading there. And afterwards, this English couple came up to me, a couple in their 60s, I suppose they were, and they said that they'd never been to Ireland before until that year. I mean, just out of interest, how many people here tonight have been to Ireland at some point? All right, well, a fair few of you, so you get the idea. Well, in my experience, English people who've never been to Ireland, it's usually for one of two reasons. Either it's because they think it's so close, it's going to be just the same as here, you know, so may as well go somewhere that's different instead, which is, of course, wrong. Or they've always thought they were going to get blown up for having an English accent, you know. And no, really, this couple in Manchester said that was it. They said they'd been frightened of going to Ireland in possession of a Manchester accent. And so they'd put it off. But they'd finally gone this year, 2000, the year the book came out. And they'd gone for a three-week holiday in June and July. And they said they'd had a fantastic time, despite having read my book while they were there. And they rented this little cottage out in Connemara, they said. And so he said they got out there, and on the first night, the English fella said that what he really wanted to do, I mean, the main thing he wanted from this holiday wasn't the scenery or anything. He wanted to see if it was true what they said about Irish pubs, you know, that Irish pubs are, you know, in a different league to bars anywhere else in the world. So first evening came, and out they went, but he said it was a really tiny village. You know, only 45 people lived there. So there were just the six pubs to choose from. And So he picked the most likely looking one, you know, and they went in. And he said he had a nice enough time, convivial time, nothing particularly earth-shattering happened or anything. But he said they had a nice evening. But then he said he was really surprised because around midnight, the barman put some towels on the beer pumps. And the bar, apparently, he said, it seemed to be closed. And he was really shocked by this, you know, because he had heard these rumours, you may have heard them yourself, that sometimes it is possible to get a drink after hours in rural Ireland. You know, that the licensing laws aren't always observed rigidly to the letter. But he didn't know how to go about it. You know, what was the form? How do you get served after hours? So he said he waited until a local guy, an old bachelor, an old fella in a cap and a tweed jacket, was up at the bar getting served. And so the English guy said he went and stood behind him and waited till he moved. Then he said to the barman, oh, excuse me, he said, is there any chance of another pint at all? And the barman said, "Ah, sure, yeah." So he's pouring in the pint. And the guy from Manchester said, "When do you close then?" And the barman said, "October." And he said, at this point he realised, you know, they were going to have a happy and a relaxed time while they were there. Now, I told that story when I was in Warrington, my hometown, just a few weeks ago. And after the event, this Warrington couple came up to me, and the guy said, "Oh, that story." He said, "Guess what happened to us?" And he said, "Me and my wife just went to Ireland for the first time." So he told me the story, and he said that they'd gone to Skull in West Cork, but they'd made a mistake. They'd rented a house that was 4 miles outside the village, which meant that they had to drive to and from the pub. But like the fellow from Manchester, this Warrington guy really wanted to, you know, is it true what they say about Irish pubs? So the first night, they drive down into the village, but he said he was determined, you know, not to drink and drive. Just the two halves, right, that was going to be him. So, 4 pints later, he's in the pub, and the barman said, "Will you have another?" And he said, "Oh, I don't know." He said he was racked by conscience at this point. He didn't want to drink and drive, but by now it was pouring with rain outside, so he's looking at a 4 mile walk up a mountain in a driving monsoon. I mean, if you want a taxi in Skull, you know, you need to book it 3 or 4 weeks in advance. So he didn't know what he was going to. And the barman said, "Oh, go on, are you having one?" And he said, "Oh, I don't know." He said, "What about the guards?" He said, what are the guards like around here about drinking and driving?" And the barman thought for a minute and he said, "Well," he said, "some of them do and some of them don't." So he had a couple more, he said, and a happy enough time. Now, in case you're feeling thirsty already, I'm sorry about this. It's poor psychology. I know drinking while other people can't. There will be an interval. Don't panic. Heavy drinkers in the audience or people with dodgy bladders, please understand that there will be an interval at a civilized time midway through. I'm going to be talking a lot about The Road to McCarthy, the new book. But I thought to begin with, you know, for old time's sake, I'd like to read a little bit from McCarthy's Bar, my increasingly battered copy of McCarthy's Bar. And because it kind of puts things in context, it explains, you know, why the guy with the English accents should have this apparent obsession with writing about Ireland and all matters Celtic. And as I say, I grew up in Warrington with an Irish Catholic mother and an English Protestant father. Quite an interesting place to be. So this is a bit from the beginning of McCarthy's Bar. I mean, if you're very familiar with it, just, you know, indulge me. Think of this as a sort of a greatest hits medley. a bit like Lou Reed, you know, the greatest hits before you get onto the really dodgy new material. So there we are. From the beginning of McCarthy's Bar. There's always one, isn't there? And people say to me, "Why don't you own a mobile phone?" And I say, "Well, they're a pain in the arse." They say, "Well, how's that? Give me one example." And I say, "Well, that bastard over there, you know." Tell them you're on the train. Don't say you're in the theatre, for God's sake. A guy last year, I was standing next to, and the phone rang, and he said, and you hear someone saying, "Where are you?" And he said, "I'm having a piss at Lansdowne Road," which he was at the time. Have you turned it off now? Can we all turn them off, all mobile phone owners? Because some theatres, they make an announcement beforehand, and I say, "Well, no, you don't need to do that. People aren't that thick." Let's all turn them off, because if that happens every time there's a pause, we'll be here till about 1 o'clock in the morning, you know? I'm on the plane to Cork in a cold sweat. The man across the aisle from me has a menacing aura and a dog collar. He may be a priest, but something about him, the way he seems to threaten violence even while asleep, perhaps, makes me suspect him of being a Christian brother. From the age of 10, I was taught by the Christian brothers the carrot and stick method of education, but without the carrot. My first school report said, "Peter is an unpleasant and frivolous boy who talks too much and will never make anything of himself, but he does take a punch well." From an early age in our house, it was taken for granted that Jesus was Catholic, God himself was Irish, and I had been born into a wicked pagan country. On St. Patrick's Day, you could spot all the kids from Irish families wearing huge bunches of shamrock on their blazers, in a proud display of religious and cultural heritage that also made fights much easier to start. Though my dad was English, half Irish counted as Irish when the paddy insults were flying. We lived in the industrial northwest, in Warrington, where the air tasted of detergent from the soap powder factory, so at least you knew it was clean. The rugby league team was called The Wire, after the town's main product. The brothers' school was 8 miles away, in St. Helens, a town so devastated by heavy industry, it made Warrington look like an area of outstanding natural beauty. I went abroad for the first time when I was 12. We'd been going to Ireland every year since I'd been born, but Ireland didn't count as abroad. It was simply an extension of home. But in my second year at the brothers' school, we went on a school trip to proper abroad, to our twin town, to Stuttgart. Now, I've never really approved of the idea of twinning, because places are invariably matched with other places just like them. So, if you live in, say, a stunningly beautiful medieval town with a perfectly preserved castle, or a glamorous seaside resort with a fishing harbour and miles of sandy beach, then you'll be twinned with your exquisite European equivalent. And if you live in Warrington or St. Helens, then you'll be twinned with another industrial casualty, like Stuttgart. So, having spent the first dozen years of my life surrounded by wireworks, glass factories and chemical plants, I found myself transported to a place where the high spot of the visit was a trip to a ball bearing factory. To make matters worse, I contracted hepatitis. I lost a stone in a week and turned yellow, which is quite interesting when you're 12. So the doctor arrived, a rather severe-looking elderly German gentleman in wire-framed glasses. Not the most reassuring sight in the world when you've spent the last term doing a project on Joseph Mengele, the angel of death. Now, I'd led a sheltered life until this point, and so far was completely unaware of the existence of suppositories. The news came as a terrible shock. The doctor explained in schoolboy German what had to be done. When my custard-coloured eyes glazed over in disbelief, he mimed it. But it was still difficult to comprehend. Surely not, I thought. Not with them big tablets. After all, if my parents had wanted me to have foreign objects pushed up my bottom, they could have sent me to public school. Finally, though, the message got through. The course of medication lasted a week. The first couple of days were the worst. After that, the doctor came back and mimed taking the tinfoil wrapper off. And things got much easier after that. It didn't half put me off going abroad, though. So for the next 5 years, until I was 17, when I went to Stuttgart again, out of force of habit, I gave up on abroad and stuck with Ireland, West Cork to be precise. Today, West Cork is a glamorous destination, a haven for upmarket tourists, English expats and Dutch cannabis importers. But in the 1950s and 1960s, West Cork was the arse end of the back of beyond. And that may be talking it up. My earliest memories of travelling to Ireland are of a boat called the Glengariff, which used to sail from Liverpool Pierhead to Cork. There haven't always been drive-on car ferries with reclining Pullman seats and discos and tax-free perfume. The Glengariff was a cattle boat with berths for 30 or 40 passengers as a sideline. I remember my father taking me below decks to see the animals. They were in a sort of a stable with straw. No nasty crates in those days. It all seemed perfectly natural. It was hard to tell whether the cows were going on holiday or whether they'd already been and were on their way back home. We'd leave Liverpool at night in what now seems like a scene from a black and white period movie playing inside my head. Men in hats, fog, customs officers wielding pieces of chalk. The crossing would turn rough in the early hours of the morning as we rounded the southeast corner of Ireland and the swell of the Atlantic hit the Irish Sea. The seasickness was spectacular. Today's ferries may be sleek and comfortable, but they deny young people the unforgettable experience of witnessing at first hand a cow throwing up. We used to stay at Butler's Gift, the small farm where my mother grew up. During the summer holidays, we made hay with pitchforks, drew water from the well with an enamel bucket, and went to market by horse and cart. Work stopped in the fields for the Angelus. Mass was in Latin. We searched fuchsia hedgerows for leprechauns with a net and a jar. And although it's statistically impossible in a country as moist as Ireland, I'm certain that the sun always shone. But these golden childhood memories have become a problem. For now, when I return to Ireland, I feel that I belong in a way that I've never belonged in the land of my birth. Even though I loved growing up in the north, England today leaves me feeling detached, an outsider, an observer, in some way passing through. But as soon as I hit the tarmac or the quayside over there, I feel involved, engaged, as if I've come home, even though I've never actually lived there. So what I'm wondering is this. Is it possible to have some kind of genetic memory of a place where you've never lived, but your ancestors have? Or am I just a sentimental fool, my judgment fuddled by nostalgia, Guinness, and the romance of the diaspora? Across the aisle on the aeroplane, the Christian brother is still asleep. I'd wake him and ask him his opinion, if experience hadn't taught me that the clergy can be lethal if riled in a confined space. Thank you. Thanks a lot. So I went over to Ireland and I made this little journey, and McCarthy's Bar was the result of it. And I didn't really have a plan when I went there. I was aware of having this, you know, the feeling I expressed there of belonging when I'm over there. But here was my plan, and the plan was to go over there, to travel around, and to write about what happened to me and how it made me feel. I mean, in any case, I think a lot of us plan our journeys too much. You know, when you're traveling, some of the best things that happen to you, it's a bit like life, really. It's not just on a journey, but a lot of the best things that happen to us come from unexpected directions, you know. And I think it's important when you're traveling to plan as little as possible, so you leave time for what I like to call happy accidents to happen. And anyway, I mean, most of you know Ireland, and you'll be aware that this is not a country that responds well to a rigid timetable. My cousin in Cork is a fluent Irish speaker, and he told me that there is no Irish language equivalent of the Spanish term mañana, because mañana is far too urgent a concept for the Irish to cope with. So I tried to embrace the spirit of that when I was on my journey. And I didn't even have an itinerary or a mode of transport when I first went over there. And what happened was, after a couple of days over there, I was in Drimaleague, this little village where my mother comes from, and I was at my grandfather's grave, because I like to have a good time and on my holidays, I suppose. And anyway, I went into the porch of the church, and there was this poster there, and it said St. Patrick's Purgatory. I thought, oh, what's this, a new Van Morrison album or something? And it said St. Patrick's Purgatory, unique centre of Celtic spirituality. Three-day pilgrimages, must be able to walk and kneel unaided, it said. And then it outlined the fact that this was this three-day, two-night, barefoot, no-sleeping, all-fasting pilgrimage. I thought, that'll do me. And because I realised that the pilgrimage was up in Donegal, up in the northwest corner of Ireland, and I was down in Cork in the bottom southwest. So it gave me somewhere to aim for, you know, and also a journey to deviate from. So as I was heading towards Lough Derg, if you've read the book, you'll know at any opportunity I kind of deviate from the route, because I was quite intimidated at the prospect of what this pilgrimage was going to be like. And I told the story, and that's what became the book. And the book has been very good to me. You know, has done things beyond my wildest dreams. And a couple of times recently, I've had journalists have said, how's the success of the books changed your life, you know? And what they're hoping you'll say is that you've had gold bath taps fitted, or a nasty fountain put in the front garden, or something like that, you know. And I was thinking, well, you know, it's not changed. You know, I live in the same house, kids go to the same school. How's it changed my life? And then I thought, well, yeah, it has. I've learned an awful lot, not just from the first book, from both the books, from the experience that's still continuing, you know, because you do the journey and then you write it, and then there's a wait, and then the book goes out, and then people start to buy it, and then they tell their friends. And it's a very slow burn, and it's been a very interesting process to follow. But I think One of the most important things it's taught me is the crucial difference between writing fiction and writing non-fiction, as I do. And it seems to me that this is the difference, that if you write fiction, if you write novels, then your own characters from your books can't start writing letters to you and trying to get in touch with you. Because that's what happened to me almost as soon as the first book came out. Because, of course, when I'm traveling around the place doing this, you don't tell people what you're up to, otherwise they would behave differently. And so quite early on, people started to realize that they were in one or other of the books. And they'd, oh yeah, I remember that, and they'd try and get in touch with me. And the first time I can remember it happening was from a guy, he's only in McCarthy's Bar for about half a page. And what happened, I was in Galway, into this rough little pub down on the docks in Galway City, a pub called Porreg's. And it was a hot July night, I remember. And it's a really quite a rough, it's a rough clientele down on the docks in Galway. Quite a hard-bitten crew get in there. And I was in there in shorts with an English accent, you know, but I survived, anyway, I was all right. And there were two musicians playing, two old fellas, and one was playing the guitar, one was playing the flute. They were playing traditional Irish tunes. And they'd been playing for a while, and this young guy walks in through the door of the bar. He was quite glamorous looking, quite tall, and he had long, shiny black hair tied back in a ponytail, little goatee beard. And he was carrying a violin case. And he stood there for a minute, and then he went over to the musicians, and he waited till they'd finished playing a tune. He had a little chat with them, and he took out his fiddle and started tuning up with them, and then he started playing with them. And he was fantastic. He was the best traditional Irish fiddler I've ever heard in my life. The strange thing was, he was Chinese. And I was quite intrigued by this. So I waited till the musicians took a break, and I went and had a chat with him. And he told me, he said his name was Michael Chang. I didn't put his name in the book. But anyway, he said his name was Michael Chang. And he was born in Shanghai and lived there till he was 5 years old. And then his mum and dad had emigrated to the States, and he'd grown up in Seattle. And he'd studied classical music at the Conservatoire in Seattle. And he said when he'd finished, he said he'd always loved Irish music, and he wanted to learn more about it. So he came over on a three-week holiday to Galway. And when I met him, he'd been there for 3.5 years. And I was back there 2 months ago, and he's still there. 6.5 years he's been there now. And he said to me, the musicians in this town are the best musicians I've ever played with in my life. So I just put a little abridged version of this conversation in the book. So a few weeks after McCarthy's Bar came out in hardback, I got this letter. Dear Mr. McCarthy, my name's Michael Chang. You probably remember meeting me in Porreg's. And he said, last week I was doing a gig in Westport in County Mayo, and a woman came up to me afterwards and said, ah, you must know Pete McCarthy. And he said to her, well, no, I don't think I know anyone of that name. And she said, ah, well, you must know him because you're in his book. And he said, well, I think you're mistaken. You know, I'm not in any book. And she said, well, how many Chinese Irish fiddlers are there in this country? And he said at this point, he got the title of the book. He went out to a bookshop the next day, found it. And he found the passage, and he remembered meeting me in that bar that night. So anyway, so he wrote to me, and he enclosed a copy of the book. And he said, could you sign the book and send it to my mother, Mrs. Chang, in Seattle, as it might help validate my life for her? He said it might help her understand why he hadn't become a classical musician or a corporate lawyer. And I thought, blimey, you know, what a responsibility. Because you hear novelists. Novelists are often going on about the great sense of responsibility they feel towards their characters, how they've got power of life and death over them, you know. But I thought, well, you've got a similar crucial power over your characters if you're writing nonfiction. I mean, a greater responsibility in a way, because they're real people out there living their lives. And also, you know, your paths may cross again. So you have to try and give a faithful account of what happened. And now it keeps on happening. When I was over in Ireland last year, you know, I said earlier about opening the bookstore. When I was over on that trip, I was staying for a while in a little bed and breakfast outside this village. It was February, so it got very dark very early in the evening. So it was about 6 o'clock in the evening. I thought, well, I'll go down into the pub in the village for a pint, you know. So I went out and I was walking down this lane. It's about 3/4 of a mile into the village. Very, very, very narrow, completely pitch black Irish country lane. And some headlights started coming down the lane behind me and then would disappear down a little dip. And then the headlights were there again. And I actually had to step off into the ditch to allow this vehicle to pass. And he slowed right down. And it was a builder's van, a white builder's van with ladders on the roof. And he pulled up and he wound down the window and he said, do you want to lift into the village? And I said, oh, great, thank you, yeah. So I went around the other side and I got in, sat in the van and put my seatbelt on. And I turned and looked at him. And I looked at him and I realized that the builder driving the van was a character from McCarthy's Bar. He was someone that I'd written about. And he looked at me and he thought, here's that English fecker who put me in his book. So we had this slightly tense little drive down into the village. And then we go into the village, and I was getting out, and he said, will we go for a pint? And I said, well, yeah. I said, I was going for a pint anyway. Now, in the book, I described him as a young builder with a scar on his cheek. And he was eating a very rare steak with garlic butter in this pub I was in. And we had this conversation that I put in the book, and you know, and he was a fantastic swearer, this guy. You know, he could have got in the Irish Olympic team for swearing, and there's a lot of competition to get in that team. The conversation I put in the book, he was saying, the best feckin' thing about this feckin' country is the feckin' weather. You know, if it wasn't for all the feckin' rain, it'd be feckin' high-rises, all from Glandorf feckin' harbour all the way to feckin' Baltimore, you know. So I put all this in the book. So we get, on the night I meet him in the van, we get to the village, and he said, we'll go for a pint. So we went in the pub, and we had exactly the same conversation again. It's extraordinary, it was like McGroundhog Day or something. And now it started happening with the new book. The most recent occurrence of this, there's a chapter in The Road to McCarthy about Montserrat, right, in the West Indies. And it's this beautiful island near about 25 miles from Antigua. And most people have only heard of Montserrat because of the volcanic explosions that happened there in 1997. There were huge eruptions. And this was only an island of about 12,000 people. But half of the population had to evacuate it after that. And half of the island remains an exclusion zone. The capital, Plymouth, was buried under 12 feet of volcanic ash. This is it's a British possession, you see. It's one of the last vestiges of empire. And so when the islanders asked for more aid, this was the place of which Claire Short, remember her? This is the place of which Claire Short famously said, these people will be asking for golden elephants next. A line that didn't play terribly well in the Caribbean, it has to be said. But I hadn't gone there for the volcano. I'd gone there because I'd heard these stories that Montserrat is known as the Emerald Isle of the Caribbean, and that they stamp your passport with a shamrock when you arrive there, and that the people are meant to speak their West Indian patois with a distinct West Cork lilt to it. And I'm thinking, well, this sounds like a made-up place, you know, it sounds ridiculous. But it's all true. It's the only place in the world other than Ireland where Paddy's Day is a public holiday. And so I went there for St. Patrick's Day, for St. Patrick's Week, in fact. And all these things, they have a week of festivities, culminating in St. Patrick's Day Calypso competition. I mean, isn't that fantastic? And everyone makes shamrocks out of lime leaves that they pick from the trees. It's a delightful place. And all the people, the dark-skinned people, but you look in the phone book, they're all called McNamara, O'Reilly, O'Gara, Sweeney, Lynch, all these Irish names. And it goes back to the 17th century. This is it goes back to the time of the Cromwellian campaign or massacre in Ireland, depending on your political point of view. In 1642, when Oliver Cromwell swept through Ireland trying to subjugate the place and massacred tens of thousands of people. But also 50 or 60,000 of his opponents were transported to the West Indies, where they were kept as slaves and as indentured servants. And what happened on Montserrat, you had this strange situation of an island owned by the British, but where the majority population were Irish, and then slaves started to arrive from Africa, which gives you this very rich cultural mix that you have today. It's a fantastic place, honestly. There's none of that kind of all-inclusives and that. You know the way in lots of parts of the Caribbean, they try and keep tourists segregated and they keep you away from local people. And Montserrat, here's a hot tip. Montserrat is a fantastic place to visit. And you know, it's a place I can recommend in an unqualified way because, you know, they need the tourist dollar because hardly anyone goes there now because of this constantly active volcano. But I prefer to see it as an asset. I mean, how often on a holiday do you see a volcano that's active all the time? On my first morning there, I was sitting outside the hotel, lovely little hotel, just these little bungalows in a tropical garden sloping down to the sea. And there was only one other guest in the hotel, and he was a seismologist who'd been sent by the British government to monitor the volcano. And I was getting me toast and marmalade, and the volcano, I mean, it's right there. It looks like it's at the end of the garden. It's about 4 miles away, and it's just very imposing. And I was just picking up my toast, and suddenly the ground started rumbling underneath me, and I looked up, and there was a mushroom cloud belching out of this volcano, and I thought, bloody hell, what have I got myself into here? And the waitress looked at me, and she said, good puff, eh? And I said, yeah, fantastic puff. So not many people go there because of the volcano, and also because there's no airport there. So So, because it was destroyed by the volcano, you see. So you've got to go to Antigua, which is what I did, and then get the ferry to Montserrat, right? Well, because Antigua is a separate country and they want to keep the tourist dollar for themselves, they only allow one ferry a day to go at 6 o'clock in the morning. And you have to get there at 5 o'clock to get a ticket because you can't pre-book it. So you've got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get down to the ferry port. So I got up at 4 o'clock and I couldn't even get a glass of orange juice or a cup of tea, let alone any breakfast. So I got to the ferry port and I was really parched, thirsty, you know. I thought I'd get something at the port. Nothing open. Couldn't even get a glass of water. It's all right, I'll get something on the boat then. So we get on the 6 o'clock ferry, but there's only 14 passengers on this 300-seat ferry because of the volcano, you see. There was a couple of local families returning and a few day trippers from Antigua going over just to check out Montserrat. So there was nothing open. I couldn't even get a glass of water on the boat. So I was parched. And I got cornered by this English guy. Very boring, retired Englishman. He was dressed all in Millet's leisure wear. And so in the book, I refer to him as Millet. And he kind of cornered me and started banging on to me, telling me all about his life and about his son who lives in Sweden. And he was so boring, he had, at 6 o'clock in the morning in Antigua, he had a Tupperware box with sandwiches in it. Now, he was from Caterham in Surrey. I don't know whether he brought the sandwiches from Caterham or whether he'd got them locally. But he had a can of ice-cold Fanta orange, you see. And he's sitting there sipping his orange and saying to me, oh, yes, my son, he lives over in Sweden now. And I'm thinking, give us a drink, you bastard, will you? Yes, and tell me all about his son who's over there, and he's married a Swedish girl now. And occasionally when he's over there, they go together to Denmark on cheap booze shopping. I'm thinking, give me a bloody drink, will you? And so he's banging on about his son in Sweden and telling me all about it. And then we're arriving in Montserrat, so the ferry stops and starts to go to reverse into the harbour. And he drains the can of Fanta, so that's my last chance gone there. He drains the can of Fanta and says, well, enjoy your holiday. And then he threw the can over his shoulder into the Caribbean. I was stunned, you know, that anyone who could be motivated to go to such a special and out-of-the-way place as Montserrat, that they would treat the environment in this way. So I thought, I'll have you bastard. So I went straight off to the hotel and wrote my account of what had just happened. I'll put that in the book, see how he likes that, you know, get my little bit of revenge on him. So, about 7 weeks ago, I was opening my post one morning. Now, I've got a website, apparently, but I've never seen it because I don't own a computer or a bloody mobile phone. And I bet you've got two computers, haven't you? And so I haven't got a computer, but apparently if you try to send me a message, you get a message back saying that I can't respond to email, but that if you'll write a letter, preferably handwritten, to my publishers, they'll forward it, and I'll write back. And it seems to kind of, you know, sort out the people who really do want to get in touch with you. So I write back to people who write to me. So I get this little envelope with about half a dozen letters in from the publishers this morning, so about 7 weeks ago. So I open the first one. Dear Mr. McCarthy, you probably don't remember meeting me on the ferry to Montserrat. I do actually, yeah. Imagine my shock as I got back to Gatwick Airport and saw your photograph on the cover of a book called McCarthy's Bar. I had no idea you were a travel writer. I have read McCarthy's Bar and enjoyed it very much. Oh, that's all right, I turned over the page. I am now reading your new book, The Road to McCarthy. Currently, I'm up to chapter 5, and I'm enjoying it very much. I thought, you're going to have a bloody nasty shock when you get to chapter 9, mate. And it haunted my life. You know when everything's good in your life, you know, personal life, emotional life, you know, you're happy, and you think, oh, God, things couldn't get better. And then you remember some filthy, dark secret, and you think, oh, God, yeah, oh, and it casts a shadow over your life. That's what it was like with me. I'd be thinking, oh yes, lovely morning, lovely day, things are going really well, publishers are ringing, oh yes, good news, oh, family are well, everything's great. And then I think, oh, bloody hell no, I'd remember, I'd think, Millet's reading the book, and I just have I'd have this vision of him reaching the chapter that's about him and thinking, oh, bloody hell, this is awful, you know. So anyway, the very first date of this leg of the tour was in Bromley in Kent, in the library. Now, it wasn't like this. It wasn't a lovely theatre like this. It was in a big room above the library that was lit with sort of strip lights. And I wasn't doing a full evening. I was just doing a short little talk and a reading. So the lights were on. But I was aware, I thought, Bromley, it's only about 15 miles from Caterham. What happens if bloody Millet turns up, you know? And so, but because the lights were on, it was very informal. I just kept an eye out watching people come in. No sign of him, right? So, this was the first event I'd done since receiving the letter from him. And what I like to do is, you know, when stuff happens to me in real life, I just put it straight into the stage show and tell people about it, you know. So I put it straight in that night, and I said, oh, about this letter I'd had, you know, first time someone from the new book had got in touch with me. And I told the story about him and how boring he was and his can and his bloody boring son in Sweden and all the rest of it. Anyway, afterwards, after the event, I was signing books, as I will be doing tonight. Have I mentioned that? Anyway, I was signing books. And the woman at the front of the queue, it was quite a long queue, and there was someone from my publisher standing there watching them. And the woman at the front of the queue, she had four books for me to sign. And she said, oh, two of them are for my Irish friend. She said, oh, I have this great life. She said, I live half the year in Galway and Connemara, and half the year in the West Indies. And I said, oh, that sounds fantastic. She said, oh, yeah, it's great. And she said, last year, she said, me and my friend were traveling round in the West Indies. And she said, we were in St. Martin in the Dutch West Indies. And she said, they were on a little bus traveling up country somewhere. And her friend had brought a copy of McCarthy's Bar, and they were reading little bits of it to each other, the account of the pilgrimage at Loch Derg that I mentioned earlier. And she said, her Irish friend started laughing so much that she wet herself on the bus. And I'm thinking, oh, how great it is to be part of the literary world, you know. And the West Indian women on the bus thought this was hilarious and pointed it out to the driver, who stopped the bus so that she could get off. And anyway, so off she got off the bus. And so I signed the books, and I'm thinking, God, how embarrassing is that? And I was thinking that, this voice said, did I really throw the can into the sea? Fucking hell no, it's Millet, like a foot away from me. And I was rigid with embarrassment. I didn't know what to say. And all the people in the queue were laughing, and my publisher thought it was very funny. And I just sat there tongue-tied, and he said, to break the silence, he said, my son's over from Canada, Sweden, I brought him along tonight. Oh, bloody hell, no! No! But the strange thing was that he didn't seem in any way embarrassed, you know. He just said, oh, will you sign the book for me, please? I enjoyed it very much. All right, so I put, to Millet on page 289, I'm very, very sorry, please forgive me, and thank you very much. And he's not in tonight, isn't it? It's a bit of a long hike to come up here. So, as well as going to Montserrat, the second book, The Road to McCarthy, it pursues different Irish themes to different places around the world, and some of them sort of interconnect. And it had never been my intention to write a second book that dealt with Ireland in any way. The plan, such as it had been, was to write about Arizona or Mexico next. And then what happened was, after McCarthy's Bar came out, and I went on tour, you know, doing readings and events like this, and I went abroad. I went to the States and to Canada, to Australia, to Hong Kong. And stories started to come back to me. People started to tell me about their experiences. And particularly in Australia, I started getting these people telling me either about how their family had ended up there. And I met this woman who she'd known her great auntie, and her great auntie, when she was a little girl, had known her Irish relative who'd been transported out there. It's that close in living memory out there, you see. So people had stories like this for me, and also these fantastic historical stories that, you know, we never really learn about in this country, about the experiences, particularly of Irish political prisoners who'd been sent out to Australia. And in the States, in New York, I stumbled across what I think are probably the world's only Irish Republican hip-hop band called Shaunikee, and I thought there was an interesting story to tell there. And I started to think, well, you know, maybe there's a global journey here. I found myself kind of itching to go on this global journey. And I thought, well, if I enjoy it, you know, there's a chance that the readers will enjoy it too. But then the day that clinched it for me, I was in Toronto, and I'd been asked to speak at this literary brunch, which was a rather scary event, where about 300 people turn up to this big banqueting hall in a hotel. And they all eat smoked salmon and scrambled eggs and drink Buck's Fizz. This is a Sunday morning, about 11 or 12 o'clock. And then three hapless authors get up and have to speak for 10 minutes each about their work. And then you go and sit at three little tables at the back and see if anyone comes and buys your books. It's very character building. And anyway, it went all right. But while I was talking, I was telling people about, you know, I mentioned in that reading earlier about the shamrock that we used to get every year for St. Patrick's Day. And those of you of a certain age will remember this used to happen. But we used to get two parcels from Ireland every year. One was a little box that arrived in March with the shamrock in. And you, and some years it would have died, or, you know, it would have gone all brown on the way, but you had to pin it on your blazer anyway, otherwise your mum got really upset, you know. And but the other parcel that arrived every year came a few days before Christmas, and it was a sack with a dead turkey in it. No wrapping paper or note of explanation or Christmas card or return address. It was just a Hessian sack with stamps on and an address on it and a nude dead turkey inside. Now, and that doesn't happen anymore either. I mean, I'm sure it's against the law to send naked poultry through the post these days, though I believe there is a shop in Amsterdam that will send you photographs if you ask them. And I remember thinking at the time as a kid, you know, there we were in Warrington. I mean, we were hardly in the lap of luxury, but I think we'd had central heating fitted, and there was a, you know, we had a telly, and there was a supermarket in town. And we were getting food parcels, you know, from relatives who had no running water in the house. And this seemed quite strange to me. So I was talking about this in Toronto, and suddenly there was a shout from this guy in the audience. This old fellow stood up and started pushing through the tables, and he came up onto the little podium I was on. And he came up and he kind of pushed me out of the way and took the microphone. He said, "Oh, excuse me," he said, "but," he said, "I've got to share something with you." He said, "I've got to tell you something and share it with the people here." He said, "You've reminded me of something from my own childhood that I'd forgotten all about." He said, "We used to get the sack with the turkeys in." And he said he was 80 years old, right? And he'd been born in Canada, out in the Midwest. But his mum and dad were from Sligo in the west of Ireland. And he said he'd grown up in, you know, extreme poverty. This would have been the 20s and the 30s in the Midwest of Canada. And he said, but we used to get the turkey in the sack. And he said, "I remember the first year it arrived." And he said, it arrived and, you know, they'd never had anything like this before. And, you know, they never got to eat turkey. So there was no way they were going to wait till Christmas Day with it. I mean, also, I suppose there was no way of knowing how long it had been in the post, you know. So his mum put it straight from the sack into the oven. Hour and a half later, there was this fantastic explosion and the door blew off the oven. When I was a kid. And it was like a Dave Allen joke. Dave Allen used to tell jokes about people smuggling poutine in holy water bottles and Lourdes water bottles. Well, my uncle Charles was out of that joke. You know, whenever he used to come across the Irish Sea, he would bring poutine in a Lourdes water bottle. Never got caught at Liverpool, and the bottles would be kept in my parents' wardrobe. But you know, you had to know which was the real holy water and which was the, you know, in case someone needed anointing. You know, you had to know which was which. But one Christmas, my mother said, "Oh, why don't we try putting poutine on the Christmas pudding instead of brandy?" So she put it on and lit it, and woof, the flames hit the ceiling. And she got a tea towel and tried, and it wouldn't go out. It took about 10 minutes to put it out, and then the pudding sat there for about a quarter of an hour, and then just spontaneously burst into flames again. It was like one of those mining disasters that burned for 3 weeks, you know. And so there I am in Toronto, and there's this old guy, and I'm thinking, well, you know, he's grown up in a different continent to me, and we're of completely different generations, but we had such specific life experiences in common. And that kind of convinced me to go for it and to try and write this global book. So The Road to McCarthy, it covers four continents. It begins in Ireland again. It begins in Cork and in Belfast. And then it pursues these different Irish stories to Morocco, that well-known Celtic hotspot, Morocco and Gibraltar. There is a reason for being there, though. And then on to New York, to Tasmania, to Montserrat, as I've said, to Montana, to Alaska, where there is a town called McCarthy, population 17. And then finally back to Ireland again, to Tipperary and to West Cork again. And you're probably getting thirsty now, and it's a hot evening, and I think you need a cold drink, really. So what I'll read a bit from the new book, and then we'll take a drinks break. And this is a bit. I'll read a bit. Yes, you need a cool drink. I'm going to read a bit from New York because not all literary events are as civilized as tonight. You know, when you build as an author, you see, you get these. You know, look how civilized tonight's audience is. Whereas, you know, years ago when I started out performing in fringe theaters and in the very early days of alternative comedy in little rooms above pubs, you know, you'd get a very different crowd. And I can't tell you how lovely it is, how relaxing it is, you know, to come along to events like this and be confronted with an audience who haven't come along with the main purpose of causing you physical or psychological damage, you know. But But not all literary events are quite as civilized as tonight. So I'll read you this bit about New York, and you'll get the meaning. It doesn't need much explanation other than to say, I went to New York. I'd heard all about the St. Patrick's Day celebrations there and the parade. And some people say it's fantastic. You know, it's the best Irish event in the world. You've really got to go there. And other people would say it's a bloody nightmare. You know, it's paddywhackery of the worst kind. Avoid it like the plague. And so I wanted to see for myself what it was like. But I didn't want to go over there and watch the parade. I thought it would be nice to march. I wanted to march up Fifth Avenue with people cheering, and so I could see what it was like. But you could only march in the parade if you're a member of one of the affiliated Celtic organisations, and I wasn't. So I was going to have to gate crash the parade. So that's the background. And but while I was there, I'd rather naively agreed to do something else instead. And so we'll take a break after this. It had seemed the most natural thing in the world to say yes when I was asked if I'd like to do some sort of performance or reading while I was in Manhattan. How glamorous it would sound to say I was doing a gig in New York City. It would conjure up images of Carnegie Hall or Madison Square Garden, with Woody Allen, Norman Mailer, and Frank McCourt in the front row. But now I know the reality. I will be standing on some beer crates in a bar full of baying, jet-lagged drunks, very few of whom are likely to be avid readers. What had started out as a happy-go-lucky trip to New York to experience the world's biggest St. Patrick's Day celebrations has been transformed into a journey to the heart of darkness. A few days after returning from Morocco, I had a phone call from the woman in New York who was organizing the reading. It was clear from her voice that something was wrong. She said, "Our literary events are very popular." "Good," I said. "It's just that, well, you know, you'll probably be okay. But, you know, it is the Wednesday before St. Patrick's Day when you'll be reading." I said, "I knew that. That's why I was coming." "Oh, okay. So you know that all the Celtic boys will be in town? You know, the football fans from Glasgow. They come over every year for Paddy's Day for the whole week, and they go kind of crazy. It's wild. The thing is, they use the bar where you'll be reading as their headquarters. By Wednesday, there'll be a whole bunch of them in there. It might not be like a regular reading. They kind of drink a lot, and that, like, frightens away the regular audience. So you might be faced with a lot of very drunk Scottish guys. But hey, I'm sure everything will be okay." So I told her I was sure everything would be okay, too. And then she said it again, which is when I knew I was really in trouble. And then she said, "Hey, you've got an Irish name, but you sound like English." I said she had a good ear for accents. And then she said, "I wonder if the Scottish guys will notice your accent." "Only, you know, they can get a little, like, boisterous." "Oh, I doubt they'll notice," I said, as my bowels turned to acid rain and my mouth dried up and shriveled like a Christian brother's heart. "I doubt they'll notice. I'm sure everything will be okay." Fast forward to the day of the New York reading. This morning I discovered it's actually possible to be nervous while you're still asleep. I woke up filled with dread, my stomach churning, even though for a moment I couldn't remember why. I must have been like that all night. No wonder I felt exhausted. And then the realization came flooding in. Tonight's the night. As I dressed, I found myself thinking back many years to the first performance our newly formed theatre company ever gave outside the safety of our home enclave of Brighton. To the terror of some of the Southerners in the cast, we had been booked by the Merseyside Arts Association to do a short tour of pubs in Liverpool in an evangelical and potentially life-threatening initiative to take theatre to venues that had never experienced it before and inflict the arts on people who didn't bloody well want them. After a slow and depressing trip up the M6, during which our most gifted performer, who was due to appear in women's clothing in Liverpool, tried to escape at Keel Services, we arrived in Halewood and started looking for the first night's venue.
After 10 minutes driving round bleak-looking tower blocks in a mood of escalating panic, we pulled over at a bus shelter to ask directions. It wasn't until we stopped that we discovered the only person in the shelter was a Hell's Angel, a massive man in biker's leathers with terrifying tattoos all over his hands. A whimper of fear came from the back of the transit as I rolled down the window. "Excuse me, mate," I said in a well-practiced "I'm not a woolly back, I'm a Scouser" accent. "Excuse me, do you know the way to a pub called the Leather Bottle?" Yeah, said the Hell's Angel. "Do a U-ey back up the road. Second left, first right. You're there." "Thanks, pal." "No problem." We were just about to pull away when the Hell's Angel spoke again. "I wouldn't go there if I was you, though. It's really fucking rough." When we arrived, the landlady told us that there'd been a murder in the public bar. A murder in the public bar on Saturday night. "Don't worry about that, though, love. You're on in the lounge." But do you know what? They loved us. I've been trying to remind myself of that all day in New York. As I came round the corner on my way from the subway, past Curry in a Hurry, I heard the noise for the first time. A raucous Glaswegian rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone that I knew wasn't coming from any of the vegetarian Indian restaurants on the street. And now I'm standing in the doorway surveying the carnage, wondering whether to take the three steps down into the heart of the Fenian carnival or turn on my heel and flee. I can't even see the bar on account of all the Scotsmen draped in green, white and orange Irish flags, jumping up and down and waving half pints of whiskey in the air. They're dancing now, or at least some of them are, not kids, but men in their 30s and 40s, jigging on the spot and propping each other up with their heads like the poles of a drunken teepee. I try and push my way through the crowd, only without pushing. Directly in front of me is a huge guy with a little green-dyed shamrock of hair on the back of his otherwise shaven head. Big mistake. Skulls as lumpy as his should be kept hidden from view, especially when they've got no neck. His head just seems to grow straight out of his chest and shoulders, like a massive tumour with a face painted on one side and a shamrock on the other. He'd have been better off sticking with a centre part in and split ends. But who's going to be brave enough to tell him? Not me. Glasgow Celtic Supporters Club, Tim's on tour, says a green Lycra leisure top stretched as tight as a lager and lime condom over the grotesque dome of his belly, giving him the alarming profile of a man who has recently swallowed Robbie Coltrane. A frightening man who has just missed his mouth with his drink and has iron brew dripping from his chin seizes my arm. One side of his face is drooping in a way that suggests he may be suffering from Bell's palsy. I hadn't realised until now that it's named after the whiskey. I managed to worm my way undetected through the Caledonian frenzy to the far end of the room, where a tiny handful of bewildered New York literary types with no previous experience of our glorious sporting traditions are trapped between the stage and the mob without protection of water cannon. Surveying the scene with his arms folded and a hint of a smile is Chris, who owns the bar. "So, Peter," he says, "are you ready?" I do my best to convey confident and nonchalant enthusiasm, but it comes out as a nod, a squeak and a wince, as if I've just heard that Brother Dermot is going to hit me with the leather strap again, and I'm trying to pretend it won't hurt. Chris takes the microphone and says a few words of welcome, but the decibel level from the mob doesn't drop. Usually, this is a bad sign. He ploughs on in his deep Donegal Brooklyn brogue, and eventually they start to notice he's there. He says, "I'd like to welcome all our visitors from Glasgow." There's a huge roar, as if the blades dropped and another head's just fallen into the basket. "So please, This is his first appearance in the United States. So I'm asking you to give a big New York City welcome to... Right, I managed to get to the microphone without collapsing. Okay, loud and direct, look him in the eye, don't go backwards, and don't leave any gaps they can try and fill in. Well, thanks, Chris. It's really great to be here. And then a voice calls out from in front and somewhere to my right. I think it might be the singer from the Celtic Supporters Club band who are on after me. And the voice says,
"Hey, pal, you're fucking English."
There are times when life seems hyper vivid, super real, and this is one of them. It's a very special moment. Nerve ends are tingling. Never have I been more exhilaratingly aware of the fact that I am alive. The only question is, for how long? See you after the break. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Cheers. Now, those of you who were back from the bar in time would have heard the announcement, the taped announcement about no mobile phones being used. That may be the first time in the history of British theatre that a taped public service announcement has got a big laugh. I really enjoyed that moment. I've also been asked to tell you that you're not allowed to use pneumatic drills, Kenwood mixers, or Ann Summers electronic products during the performance. There's been some complaints about the temperature as well. I'm really, really sorry. The management have asked me to say they're working on it, and the heating should be back on shortly. So, I was over in Ireland just a few weeks ago, and I saw a great cartoon in a magazine there, and it was an archaeological cartoon, which you don't often see, and it was these archaeologists delving around in the ruins of an old abbey, and there were, you know, there was old gravestones that had fallen down and Celtic crosses and all that. And this one guy is looking underneath in the ruins, and he finds this enormous illuminated manuscript, a big ancient tome, you know, and he dusts off all the muck and the cobwebs to reveal the title, and it says, "Irish Dancing, Volume 2, Use of the Arms." Now, that's a joke from Ireland, which isn't the same as an Irish joke, of course. And when I was a kid, I used to hate all those thick paddy jokes that people used to make, because they'd find out that you were from an Irish family, and I'd be, you know, thick this and that. And I could never understand, you know, what was meant to be so funny about these jokes, and why didn't they make jokes about people from Surrey or something? But then later in life, when I was in my teens, I realised when I was in Ireland that people in Ireland make Irish jokes as well, but they make them about people from County Cork, which is where my family are from, you see. So that my family were bottom of the Irish intellectual heap. And particularly in Kerry, of course, they like to make these jokes about people from Cork. And when I was writing McCarthy's Bar, I did actually come across one that I really liked. I was in Tralee having a bit of lunch in a hotel lounge, and there were these two guys in there, two local fellas, and they were telling each other Cork man jokes. And my favourite one was about the Cork man who agreed to go on Mastermind. And he went on Mastermind, and his chosen subject, his specialist subject, was Ireland, the Easter Rising, and the War of Independence, 1916 to 1921. So the Cork man went and he sat on the stool in the spotlight, and Magnus Magnusson's voice came through. Name any one of the leaders of the Easter Rising at the GPO in Dublin in 1916. And the Cork man said, "Pass." Name the Irish political and military leader who negotiated the Treaty of Partition with the British. Pass. Name the first president of the Irish Free State. Pass. And a voice came from the audience. "Good man, pass. Tell the bastards fuck all." It's a cracker, isn't it? Have that one on me. It's now. Ah, yes, the books. That's why we're here, ostensibly. For the Road to McCarthy, there's two chapters in there about Tasmania, specifically about Tasmania, not about the rest of Australia. And I thought it was a wonderful place, this island off the southern coast of Australia. But I found that it charmed me and terrified me in equal measures. You know, I think there are some places in the world where events of such emotional extremity have taken place that they've left their impression on the soul of the place, that the place almost feels haunted by what's gone on there. You can touch it, you can feel it creeping over you. I certainly felt that in Tasmania, because this is a place with a very troubled history, you know, where the indigenous people who'd been there for 25,000 years were effectively wiped out within 60 years of the Europeans arriving, of it being taken over and used as a British penal colony at the beginning of the 19th century. And it was a very brutal penal colony as well. And I remember someone pointing out to me an island off the shore of Port Arthur, which was the big one of the biggest penal colonies there. And they said, oh, this island, this was Point Pur, it was called. You know, Pur, the Latin word for boy. This was where the child convicts were kept. I said, what? The children who were transported from England and Ireland. This was the island on which they were incarcerated. And I hadn't contemplated this, that child convicts were sent to Tasmania, you know, Van Diemen's Land as it was then. And the guy pointed out to me those white cliffs, he said, they were the traditional place of suicide for the boys. God, you know, and this was all going on. This was the height of Victorian civilization, you know, while George Eliot was at home writing Middlemarch, you know, and this was what was going on down there. But what had drawn me to Tasmania, I mentioned earlier about these Irish political prisoner stories, and I came across this wonderful story about a group of people called the Young Islanders, who were sentenced in 1847, I think, in Clonmel in County Tipperary. They were sentenced for sedition against the British Crown to be hung, drawn and quartered. And then later, this sentence was increased to life in Australia. And I can't tell you what a pleasure it was to deliver that line in Sydney. And I was drawn to their story because these were guys who had been fighting for Irish independence. And three of the leaders of the group were Protestants. And I thought this was quite interesting because in this country, I think the Irish political situation has always been seen in sectarian terms, you know, Catholic, nationalist, Protestant, loyalist, and it's always been like that. And in fact, it hasn't always been such a clear division. And I thought, well, I like the story and I would like to draw more attention to it. And what I found out was that they were, when people were sent to Tasmania, bear with me, some of you will know this already, but I didn't when I started researching it. They weren't kind of locked up when they got there. They were free, within certain limits, to wander and live a life. They were assigned to work, you know, so if you were a print worker or a farm labourer or a cobbler or whatever, you were effectively licensed slave labour until you'd worked out your sentence and then you could try and earn a living. But if you reoffended while you were there, then you were incarcerated in one of these terrible places. And I was much drawn to the story of one of these young islanders, this guy called Thomas Francis Maher, who was a great orator. And when they were sent over there, these six guys who were sentenced, they were each put in a different district of Tasmania and were told that as long as they stayed within their district and didn't try and meet the others and didn't try and escape from Tasmania, then they were free to roam. You know, they could ride horses and go down the pub and have love affairs and all kinds of things. And this guy, Maher, discovered that the district that he was assigned, part of its border was a river called Blackman's River. And one of his colleagues was on the district on the other side of the river. And there was this village called Tunbridge that straddled the river. So what Maher arranged was for the landlord of the local pub, every Monday lunchtime, to set up a table on this bridge right at the center of the river. And then Maher would come from his district and this other guy would come from his district and they'd sit and have lunch at this table, each of them still technically within the district he'd been sentenced to by the courts. And I thought this was a great sort of historical, practical joke. And I really, I wanted to kind of trace the places that these guys had been to while they were over there. But I really wanted to find this bridge, you see. So I went to Tasmania and I'd never been there before. I've been to Australia many times, but I'd never been to Tasmania. And it's the place that people on mainland Australia, they make all the Irish jokes about it and all the, you know, the sheep jokes and all the, you know, all the inbreeding jokes and all that stuff, usually made by people who haven't been there. It's a beautiful island. 40% of it is still wilderness. But as I say, it's very, very spooky because, I think, of the terrible things that have happened there. And also because it looks wrong. You'll see sort of a 19th century European house, but the flowers around it are wrong, and the trees are wrong, and the lights come in from the wrong angle. And it's like seeing Europe in a nightmare, almost, or in a dream, you know. And so I arrived in Hobart Airport and drove along this beautiful, empty, deserted road into Hobart itself, this lovely little country town on the banks of this enormous harbour. And your first thought arriving from Europe is, you know, where are all the people? Because Tasmania is about the same size as Ireland, but only 450,000 people live there. It's a very empty place. And so I went into Hobart. And I checked into a little hotel down on the waterfront, and I went for a walk around town and thought, you know, to sort of get the feel of the place. I didn't quite know what my itinerary was going to be. And I realised I needed a new notebook, and so I looked out for a bookshop or a stationer's, and I found one. I went in, and the bookshop, like the streets outside, was virtually deserted. There was just this one woman in there browsing, and I got my notebook. I went to the cash desk. I was paying for it. And as I was paying for it, this woman, this customer, came and stood next to me, and she put her purchase down on the counter, and I turned and looked, and it was a paperback copy of McCarthy's Bar. And I was just staggered at the coincidence of it. It had only been out in paperback for about 3 weeks. So, I'd never actually been in a shop and seen someone buying it. You know, it's a bit undignified, really, isn't it? You're hanging around in a bookshop to see, are they going to buy one of mine? You know, and anyway, you know, the whole point of books is that, you know, the book is there on the shelf in the bookshop doing an honest day's work. While the author is at home in bed or, you know, down the pub or something. That is why, historically, why books were first invented. So I'd never actually seen this happen before, and I thought, what a coincidence, you know, that all she could be buying, she's bought this. Then I thought, hang on, what? Look at this from her point of view. What are the chances on you going into a bookshop, right? Picking a book, going to the cash desk, and the only other person in the shop being the person who wrote the book? I mean, what are the odds against that happening? Especially in bloody Tasmania. You know, it must be millions and millions to one. So I kind of looked at the book, and she caught my eye and half smiled, and I said, oh, what a coincidence. And she said, what? Oh, no, I've started that. I said, oh, you know, the book. And she said, what about it? And I said, well, it's my book. And she looked at me and grabbed the book and pulled it along the counter away from me like this. She said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I wrote that book, actually. She said, I don't believe you. And then it got really pathetic. I said, I did, honest. I said, look, I'm even wearing the same jacket that I was on the cover of the book, which was true. That's how glamorous my life is. And at this point, the bookseller joined in to help me, and he said, oh, Pete McCarthy, McCarthy's back. He said, oh, yeah, funny book. You'll really enjoy that. He said, okay. So I just turned to go, and she said, oh, hang on. She said, would you mind signing the book for me? I said, no, that's all right. So I signed it for her, and she said, ah, geez, mate, I'm real sorry. I thought you were a fucking loony. That was the first person I ever spoke to in Tasmania. And now, look, at this point, I'm going to try and... And then a couple of weeks later, someone persuaded me to do a little reading while I was in Tasmania. So I agreed to do a reading. There's this nice pub in the centre of Hobart, an old Victorian pub, where they have Irish music sessions on a Saturday at about 5 or 6 o'clock. And so I did a little reading beforehand, and so I opened it with that story, because, you know, it had only happened a week or so earlier. And I finished the story, and this voice in the audience went, I'm over here! She said, I've brought me mum! Thank you. So I could say to the audience, look, I don't make this stuff up, you know, here she is. Now, what I'm going to try and do now is deftly pull together two different strands of the evening. There's the Tasmanian strand that we've just established, but I'm also going to go back to the first half. And now, the more observant amongst you may have noticed that in the second half, we have upped the technological ante over here. And remember, in the first half, I was talking about meeting characters from my own books and what happens if you meet them or how embarrassing it can be or anything. But I realized a while back, I thought, well, there's another side to this as well, because if I want, because the people I write about are real, I can bring them on stage with me if I want, you know, so, which is what I'm going to do tonight. Don't always do this, but sometimes when the dates work out, I'm able to do it. So what I'm going to do is bring on someone from... Hmm? Bring on Millie. Yeah. It'd be nice, wouldn't it? But he'd just come on and he'd suddenly say, hello. And he'd be gone, see? And you'd say, money back, and the theatre would be closed down and my career would be in ruin. And it'd be terrible. Are you his son? Millie's at home saying, I want you to go to... Here's the list of all the shows this man's doing. I want you to go to every one and shout my name out. Yes, Dad, I will. All right, Dad. Now, someone more interested and marginally more talented than Millet, I think you'll find. And you're going to bring him on. We're going to do something together. Well, what I'll do first is I'm going to read a bit out of the book that's about him, and then when he comes on, you can see whether he measures up, you see. And now, and he's out of McCarthy's bar, and it's from near the end of the book. When, you know, and I told you about the pilgrimage I went to at Loch Derg. And this, so you go there for 3 days, and you're barefoot all the time, and you're not allowed to sleep, and you've got to fast all the time. You're allowed 1 meal a day of either hot water or black tea with either dried biscuit or dry toast. Yeah, it's quite a liberal regime, really. And you're warned that at the end, when you leave the island after 3 days, that you have to let your system down gently, you know, because you've been starving it so much and, you know, it'll go into some sort of shock. Now, the mistake I made was remembering that I knew someone that I knew from way back who had been living in Donegal for a good while, and he was only living about 30 miles away from Loch Derg. So I went to recuperate from the pilgrimage with him. And after a few days with him, I had to go back to Cork to recuperate from the few days with him, you see. So here's how it occurred. Donegal was a black hole into which I almost disappeared without trace. I entered a twilight world where breakfast was at 1:30 in the afternoon, and you'd have to beg to be let out of the pub at 4:00 in the morning. Such are the consequences of accepting hospitality from a musician. Paul is a guitarist and songwriter I knew in England who's been living in Donegal for several years. I decided to call on him the day I left Loch Derg. I reached his place at about 2:00 in the afternoon and assumed he was out when I got no answer. It hadn't occurred to me that he hadn't woken up yet. I was surprised and rather delighted to discover that the Loch Derg experience had left me feeling high and warm and positive. Though, by the time they let us out of Paul's local in the early hours of the following morning, the spiritual effects had been somewhat dissipated. I am now in a position to confirm that after fasting for 3 days, drinking stout for 12 hours, with only a bowl of seafood chowder to help absorb it, quickly brings on the most violent symptoms of an amoebic and fatal tropical disease. I had to burn the clothes, actually. Rising at 2:00 in the afternoon to cook bacon on a single man's grill pan does nothing to improve the situation. I carried on like this for 4 days, hopelessly jet-lagged from the sleepless nights on Loch Derg and from this timetable on which only owls, badgers, and musicians could survive. It was bloody marvellous. Please welcome to the stage, he's come from Donegal, where he lives, to be here with us tonight, the man from page 313, Paul Buckley. He's been up a couple of hours and he's ready to rock. You all set? Good. Now, we're going to do something about Tasmania, as I said. And this was just a description of me leaving Hobart and setting out into this rather spooky environment for the first time. Okay? Good. On the wrong page, Paul. Give us a minute. Now that's the wrong page too. It's here somewhere. Just chat amongst, phone people up, you know. Give your dad a ring, see how he's going. Here it is. I found it. It's the beginning of the southern winter, grey and cool with a spray of drizzle in the early morning air as I leave Hobart. Australians have been very skillful in projecting an image of a lucky country of perpetual sunshine, where winter never happens, because they know it makes us unhappy. And it's important for Australians to know that the Poms are miserable. Here in Tasmania, though, with nothing but 2,000 miles of Southern Ocean to separate it from Antarctica, they say it can get quite drafty. Traffic is light, though for all I know, this may qualify as gridlock in Hobart. It feels quite unlike the centre of a capital city. I find myself looking at the other drivers and envying their lives in such a pristine, unpressured environment. The island also lays claim to the freshest air in the world. Everywhere in my hotel was non-smoking, even the balconies. One day, Tasmania could become the world's first non-smoking island, and smokers will have to get the ferry to Melbourne if they want to stand in a doorway and have a fag. There are gum trees and empty hillsides as the road splits, and I take the left fork to the west coast. The drizzle has stopped, but ahead of me is a wall of mist. Seconds later, I'm enveloped in it. The mist is an opaque and eerie yellow in the muted sun, rising in swirls from the surface of the swamp. Gnarled branches reach out of the water like drowned men's arms. It's as if I've been transported into an episode of The Twilight Zone. This is the only road from east to west of the island, but there are hardly any vehicles apart from the occasional logging truck. As the non-existent traffic becomes even more sparse, so the roadkill grows increasingly abundant. Furry casualties litter the road in oozing piles. Enormous orange-eyed birds stand defiantly astride the corpses, pecking out the tasty bits. I pass no other vehicle for 10 minutes, yet count more than a dozen dead animals. That's a hell of a strike rate. It seems statistically impossible. How can there be more roadkill than cars? Do people take detours to chase them and drive them down deliberately? Or are the beasts depressed and prone to suicide? I read a magazine article that reckoned Tasmanian hippies are so vegetarian that they make their shoes from the skin of roadkill. How messy would that be? I turn a bend, negotiate the brow of a hill, and disappear from view, knowing that as soon as I'm gone, a barefooted crusty will emerge from the bush and try a dead marsupial on for size. Queenstown, says the sign, mining since 1880. There's a solitary derelict building, then the road snakes up the stark, ravaged mountain past three or four prospectors' cabins. It's like the opening shot of a bleak and violent movie set in a 19th century mining claim in the Wild West. There's a bend at the top of the mountain, and there, far below, is a cluster of wooden buildings, dwarfed by the devastated and barren landscape, like a gold rush town on the dark and jagged side of the moon. A sign on a garage says, enter at own risk. But does it mean the garage or the town? I park outside the Empire Hotel. There's a view up a single street of run-down wooden buildings. Across the street, an elderly beaten-up white Valiant is parked at the curbside. Stretched across the front seat with his feet on the dashboard, a tough-looking man in his 30s sits staring at me. He's unshaven and covered with so much dirt that I'm only guessing about him being unshaven. The street's deserted, as if today's gunfight is due at any moment. A shop on the corner doubles as the tourist information office. There are some rocks in the window and a notice headed, Things to Do in Town. Item four is walk round the town. So I do. In the village of Ross, I go into a shop to buy the picnic I've been planning for weeks. I'm expecting to be served by one of those slick 21st century tourism operatives with anxious smiles you find everywhere these days. But instead, I get a 19th century shepherd with tree trunk arms and a Cold Comfort farm haircut. I select a straightforward meat pie from the lengthy pie menu. Instead of wrapping it up, Cold Comfort seizes a plastic squirty bottle of tomato ketchup. He's about to inject the red stuff into my pie, like a builder squirting insulation into a wall, when I spot what he's up to and ask him to desist. He's clearly alarmed by my eccentricity. And by the time I leave town, word will be out that there's a weird pie-eater on the loose. Pies are a cornerstone of Australian life. Gastronomy may be the new national pastime, but away from the Epicurean heartlands of the cities, you'll still find plenty of people whose idea of a seven-course meal is a six-pack and a pie. I put my pie into the car, fasten its seatbelt, and drive the few miles south to the village of Tunbridge. I find Thomas Francis Maher's bridge straight away. It's clearly the Victorian original, with five stone balustrades so you can calculate precisely where the table would have been placed. I put the pie on the wall exactly at the center and begin to unwrap it. As I'm doing so, an old man crosses the bridge pushing a wheelbarrow full of pig shit. He winks and smiles and gives a cheery good day as he passes. I bite into the pie in a conscious act of communion with the men whose story has brought me to the other side of the world. The pastry's fine, but God in heaven, what's this evil black slurry inside it? It reeks of something deeply unpleasant, a carrion stench that makes me gag even as I swallow. I daren't take a second mouthful, because there's a serious risk that as it's on its way down, the first one might be on its way. On its way back up. I can't eat it, and I'm certainly not letting it back in the car. I check that no one's watching, then drop the pie into the river, where it lands with a sickening plop. I'm instantly overwhelmed by guilt and regret. I may just have poisoned Tasmania's river system. The fumes could also taint the air and kill the rainforest. Too late now. The pie is caught between two stones on the riverbed, like a sealed Sellafield container waiting to surprise a future generation. I feel ashamed. I'm going to get out of here before anyone realizes what I've done. As I walk back to the car, I remember the old man with the wheelbarrow. Perhaps he was smiling and winking, because he's the guy who puts the filling in the pies. Paul Buckley. Well, like I say, Paul still lives over in the northwest of Ireland, in Donegal. So coming all this way, I think it's only fair that he should stay and perform one of his own rather wonderful songs for you. So here he is, the man from page 313.
This is a song that I wrote over in the, on a kind of the west coast of Donegal. At the time, I was receiving quite a lot of hospitality. Sweet western soul, sweet western soul, go down by the harbor lights with a good time roll. Sweet western soul, sweet western soul, just with a good time roll, steal away. Steeway, Steeway, Steeway. Sweet and strong, Atlantic Bay. Stay with me, stay with me. Stay with me, stay with me. This place will forever be. Sweet Western soul, sweet Western soul. Go down by the harbor light with a good time. Thank you.